Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. One guest today, Tithi Bhattacharya, editor of the collection Social Reproduction Theory, Remapping Class, Recentering Oppression, which was published in October by Pluto Press. Her day job is as a professor of South Asian history at Purdue University in Indiana. In the late 1970s, the economist Heidi Hartman wrote a classic essay on what she called the unhappy marriage of Marxism and feminism. The core of Hartman's critique was that Marxism, and class politics more generally, always ends up on top. As she says in the opening line, the marriage of Marxism and feminism has been like the marriage of husband and wife depicted in English common law. Marxism and feminism are one, and that one is Marxism. Gender, in her view, always ended up subordinated to class in both analysis and program. Hartman proposed instead that the two perspectives become something of a marriage of equals. As she wrote, we argue that a materialist analysis demonstrates that patriarchy is not simply a psychic, but also a social and economic structure. We suggest that our society can best be understood once it is recognized that it is organized both in capitalist and in patriarchal ways. Close quote. But are these two spheres operating semi-independently, or are they a complex unity? Over the decades, many socialist feminists have addressed these issues, not always agreeing on an answer. The collection edited by my guest, Tithi Bhattacharya, embodies an approach known as social reproduction theory, one that rejects any separation of worker and society. Society, including the family and other highly gendered relations, produces the worker, and it's a mistake to treat these as isolated systems. The collection consists of 10 essays, two of them by the editor, one an overview of the contributions, the other an examination of the spheres of production and reproduction, the economic and the social, as mutually creating each other. Other essays include Nancy Fraser on the crisis of care in contemporary capitalism, a situation in which the hunger for profit maximization destroys the social underpinning that makes it all possible, Susan Ferguson on childhood and capitalism, Sarah Psaritis Oran on pensions, Salar Mondahasi and Emma Teitelman on, among other things, the centrality to the politics of the 1930s of social reproduction struggles, and Alan Sears on sexualities. Social reproduction theory has a breadth of interest that you don't find in typical books on labor or gender. While some of this may sound abstract, it's not. It's relevant to many hot political issues today, from social security reform to Me Too. It was a subtext to the Hillary Clinton-Bernie Sanders fights of 2016. This interview was recorded a couple of weeks ago, before the final passage of the Republican tax reform bill, so please adjust the verb tenses and moods accordingly. Here's Tithi Bhattacharya. Marxism and class struggle, more generally, are often seen as centering on narrowly economic issues. The workplace, wages, hours, working conditions. You know, that famous quote from Lenin that the spontaneous consciousness of the working class is a trade union consciousness. You find these kinds of conceptions really unfair to Marx and are not really helpful to the pursuit of truth and justice generally, right?
Absolutely. And actually, this is why I think the most frequently used prefix in my work about Marxism and in the works of social reproduction feminists about Marxism is the prefix re, because we believe, or at least I believe, that this is not the central core idea of Marx or Marxism, and this is why we need to revisit Marx and actually reveal that Marxism is about much more expansive notion of both struggle as well as the expansive nature of capitalist exploitation and oppression. And this is where I think social reproduction theory develops the silences in Marx.
Marx has a couple of suggestive passages, but he doesn't really develop it very deeply, right?
Right. So, I mean, you know, Grundrisse and then Capital Volume 1, where he develops the ideas of the capitalist mode of production, basically says that the capitalist mode of production produces commodities, but at the heart of it is labor power. So it is workers and their capacity to labor that is at the source of capitalism's profit. And so the worker producing these commodities arrive at the workplace and has to sell her labor power to the boss on the basis of which capitalist profit depends. So the longer hours the worker works and so on, the more profit for the bosses. But the problem, well, there's no problem with this analysis, but the problem in Capital Volume 1 is that labor appears produced already at the door of the workplace, right? So labor power is assumed analytically in Capital Volume 1 to be simply present. And social reproduction theory urges us to neither assume that labor power is simply there nor treat its production as devoid of history. So labor power, like other things under capitalism, also has to be produced and reproduced. So this daily and generational renewal of life or labor power is the point of focus for social reproduction theory. It also explores the way in which labor power is made available, right? So there's a very wonderful argument made by, actually, to switch tracks a little bit, by Marcus Rediker in his book, The Slave Ship. And he says, you know, the slave is not captured in Africa as a slave. He or she is captured as a human being. He or she has to be made into a slave. And that process begins even before he or she lands on the shores of the New World into the plantation. The slave ship is a production site of torture and enslavement that makes a human being into a slave. So similarly, but not to that kind of a brutal extent, the human beings have to be made into wage laborers. Their labor and the capacity to work has to be attuned to capital's profit-making mechanisms in a particular way for them to be wage laborers. So social reproduction theory kind of explores the myriad veins of social relations that produce labor power and makes the worker unworker before she arrives at the doors of the factory at 9 a.m., and the processes that takes place after she leaves the workplace at 5 p.m., except that nowhere in America do people work 9 to 5 anymore.
And a lot of the analysis of how workers are produced, people are produced and reproduced, has been done by feminist scholars over the last decades. But Heidi Hartman called the long unhappy marriage of Marxism and feminism. There have been many approaches to how these things all fit together. There's something called dual systems theory. There's your approach, social reproduction theory. Could you just lay out some of the ways that people have tried to understand how these processes fit together?
Before I state my disagreements with dual systems theory, I think we must all acknowledge one of the things that dual systems feminists try to bring attention to. In general, second wave feminists try to bring attention to the fact that unpaid domestic labor was an absolutely crucial part of capitalist reproduction of capitalist social relations. Where it went, I would say it kind of moved away from Marxist analysis and hence the unhappy marriage, is it saw a separate system of patriarchy that reproduced sexual oppression and gender oppression and a capitalist production system that produced commodities. These two were separate. They were connected, but they were two separate systems of oppression and exploitation that borrowed from each other, but were not necessarily the same system. And this is where I think social reproduction theory says, well, actually, sexual oppression, while distinct from the production of commodities, is actually not a separate system of patriarchy. It is simply a unitary system of capitalist social relations and capitalist production, where there are distinct social processes that produce life and distinct social processes that produce commodities, but the two are intrinsically related. So, I mean, if you think about it, the relationship between the production of value or the production of life and the production of commodities and value and the production of life is not just intrinsically connected, but the relationship is both necessary and contradictory. It is necessary because, you know, obviously capitalist production needs labor power, otherwise, without which value could not be produced and the system could not be reproduced. And workers, who are the bearers of labor power, need wages and social services through which they can meet their basic subsistence needs. So in that sense, it is a necessary relationship. But it is also contradictory because the capitalist must, in order to remain competitive, create conditions whereby human needs is subordinated to profit-making or accumulation. So in other words, they must also limit or lower wages and social spending that pay for the renewal of the workforce, and hence lower the spending for the renewal of life.
One of the contradictions of this, of course, is that capitalists who make consumer goods are always trying to sell us more stuff, which, you know, pushes up workers' demands. At the same time, you know, other capitalists want to keep down those demands. So it's a field of conflict, even between sectors of the capitalist class.
This is a very, very interesting point, because this is one of the things that I think Marxism is very good at explaining. Remember where he talks about that it is always a question of relative wants. So, for instance, you know, in the days when the capitalist lived in a villa and the worker lived in, you know, tract housing, the worker would have the villa to aspire for. So her needs were shaped by the villa. But today, as the capitalist lives in an island and owns all the other islands around it, and the worker lives in a, you know, suburban house, their needs are shaped again by the relative inequality between the bosses and the workers. So the fact that capitalists constantly have to sell products to us and workers are forced to buy them in order for the bosses to remain competitive also creates needs within the working class, right? So the system itself produces the understanding that this life is not enough, in a sense. So it, while it produces needs, it also produces the horizon for workers' struggles to meet those needs. So workers can only have their needs fulfilled to a certain extent as far as the system allows the working class to satisfy their needs. But some need, in other words, analytically speaking, will always continuously remain unfulfilled for the working class. This is why, you know, I have always argued that class struggle, or the struggle for a better life, is actually intrinsically part of the capital-labor relationship.
Marx says that, you know, there's nothing, a couple of paragraphs in, I believe, Capital Volume 1, where he says that, you know, the wage is not set, you know, by some immutable natural need, that the wage is determined by what the standards of society are at any given moment, and those standards are shaped by a class struggle. So they, even the most narrowly economistic sense around the wage, that, you know, this is a product of struggle that's actually beyond the workplace, right?
Right. And I mean, you know, we've forgotten, I think, in the last 40 years of neoliberalism, that we've forgotten why are people going to work? It is not for the wage, but it is in order for the wage to fulfill human needs. So the wage is a means to life. So people forget that what the things that motivate workers to strike, even within the workplace, is not just for a higher wage, but for a fulfilled life that that higher wage will afford. So in other words, I think it is very foolish for neoliberal bosses to think that once they took away the tools for striking or struggling within the workplace, which would be our unions, when they took those away, workers would stop struggling. Because when they're quality of life is affected, when their access to social housing is affected, access to water or hospitals is affected, of course workers will struggle. And that may not be in the workplace, but it will be in working class communities or in general in ordinary people on the street as a whole. So the question of the wage being separated from life is an absolutely idiotic idea that actually does not exist in Marxism. Marxism, and particularly Lenin, talks all the time about the integrated nature of the workplace and non-workplace struggle. You know, Lenin spent his entire, the first period of his polemical rage against economistic writing, you know, of in Russia, who were basically arguing about this sort of narrow workplace focus and so on. And so this is why his famous line, the Tribune of the Working Class, must fight for all forms of oppression, not because it's a moral fight, but because every body blow against the system is actually a win for workers in general.
I'm speaking with Tithi Bhattacharya, a professor of South Asian history at Purdue and the editor of the collection Social Reproduction Theory from Pluto Press.
Ernest Mandel has a passage in Late Capitalism where he writes about the extension of needs under capitalism, the deepening of needs is actually a civilizing thing, and that there's a kind of liberal snobbery sometimes about workers wanting more stuff. That's kind of a reactionary stance, isn't it, to say that the workers want too much?
I want workers to want everything. I am always horrified when people, especially, you know, liberal news channels and liberals in general, post horrified pictures of Black Friday riots or whatever, you know, people struggling to get into Walmart, etc. You are blaming the people who are at the circus, not blaming the people who have organized the bloody circus. So, I mean, this is one day of the year that a working class family can get consumer goods and so on at decent prices. And so why the hell should they not go and buy them for themselves and their family? This is not a question of greed. If you want to talk about greed, let's talk about the handful of people who control all the wealth of the universe. But what we want to look here is, of course, working class people seek to fulfill their needs. It's not a question of greed at all. And yes, I mean, consumerism is, you know, I'm not going to say that the American worker's need is the same as the Bangladeshi worker and so on. But this kind of relative moralism is actually nonsensical. I think what we need to focus on that most working class people globally do not have what they need to reproduce their life in decent, humanitarian, and dignified conditions. This is true whether you're working in America or you're working in Bangladesh. And that is a question that is about not because they need more, but because a handful of 1%ers control most of the wealth of the world and are actually, that's where we should talk about greed. So I am all for workers wanting more things to make their lives and the lives of their families and loved ones better.
If we go back, you know, this is more of a 19th century thing that is fading in the present, but there was a sense in which the workplace is gendered male and the household is gendered female, and these two realms are really rather separate. Where are we now with that?
Well, if you look at the American context, right, I mean, the idea that there was a breadwinner and a homemaker only worked, if you follow, you know, Stephanie Coutts's work, only perhaps worked for a very, very tiny period of time in the post-Second World War era in the American context, and that too, not for everyone. So, I mean, some of the writing of Black Marxist women in the 30s and 40s is precisely about that the Black female worker has always been a worker, has never been just a homemaker. So, I mean, I think that mythology it does not hold true for the vast portion of capitalist history globally. Where it does hold true is in what you actually said, that the workplace is gendered male and the home is gendered female. So here's the problem. The idea that the two things are separate, as you know, is that the workplace and the home are two separate spheres emerged under capitalism only, because under previous modes of production, work and home were not separated out so discreetly. What has happened under capitalism, increasingly so, is, and I've used this phrase before, that the workplace has become degendered because of a very specific set of policies and practices. Workers, as socioeconomic beings, are now required to have neither race nor gender. So this is not obviously gender or race neutral policies, but is actually openly oppressive. So if you think about it, the very notion of a rigid work schedule forms the primary framework of the problem, yeah, in the sense that going into work at a particular hour, leaving work at a particular hour, these are all not set to natural biological rhythms or to seasons, et cetera, but to set to capitalism's needs. And those needs are increasing every day. So, for instance, the idea that the supermarkets are open 24/7, workplaces are open 24/7 these days is a ridiculous, if you think about it in human terms, it's a ridiculous pressure to put on the human body and the biological clock. I went to Target yesterday, and the checkout person, who is, by the way, over 70 years old, and she's working there at 9 p.m. at night, I said, so do you have to work here on Christmas Eve? And she said, yes, till 11 p.m. on Christmas Eve. So the workplace is, in that sense, extremely authoritarian, but attending to personal matters in the workplace, for instance, a phone call about a sick child, is typically discouraged because this is taking away from work time, and a majority of people don't have any control of when they can take a break during the workday. So apparently, according to one study I remember, nearly 60% of working class people, men and women, have no control over their start or end time at work. And near over 50% cannot take time off to care for sick children. So these kind of gender neutral policies at work, so-called gender neutral policies, obviously affect women far more. So in that sense, when you degender the workplace, it actually heavily affects how women can be part of the workforce in a meaningful way. So what ends up happening is, because people are forced to spend even longer hours at workplaces away from home, and because wages, particularly after 2008, are so low for a majority, that a 40-hour work week is not enough to feed your family or keep poverty at bay. And there is no childcare support. So what ends up happening is, because of these kind of policies in the workplace, and because of the fact that women are paid less in the workplace, women often end up staying home because it is cheaper for a woman to stay home and take care of the child or the aging parent, because childcare is so expensive, than for the woman to have a job. But she also has to pay some of the bills, so she ends up having part-time work and so on. So in that sense, some of these things still, the structural impulses of these highly gendered spheres still exist. But unfortunately, because wages are low for both men and women, what that means is women can no longer afford to even stay at home. So they end up having, you know, three part-time jobs, etc., to pay the bills.
These are the issues that the bourgeois press renders as problems of work-life balance.
Correct. And it is entirely untrue, because by that very phrase, it implies that the balance ought to be achieved by individuals. McDonald's and Walmart give workshops to workers about savings, how to save, because workers obviously don't know how to save, and Bill Gates does. The putting of the responsibility on the worker to achieve balance in their life, what, presumably by doing more yoga, is a ridiculous neoliberal concept. The balance should be achieved by raising the wages, by lowering the number of hours at work, by providing free childcare and healthcare to the worker. And that's how she will achieve balance in her life, not by thinking about balance or, you know, doing self-care or whatever the new buzzword is.
And that's the end of part one of my interview with Tithi Bhattacharya, editor of the collection Social Reproduction Theory. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. part two of the Bhattacharya interview after a musical break. That was some of Surreal Chemist by Stereolab. And now on to part two of my interview with Tithi Bhattacharya, editor of Social Reproduction Theory from Pluto Press.
Let's talk some about practical issues that social reproduction theory can help us think about much more clearly. For example, possibly the peak period of class struggle in the United States was the Great Depression of the 1930s. And a lot of those fights were around issues that were outside the workplace. There were intense issues of class struggle, but they were not conventional union-style issues, not, you know, the Flint sit-down strikes and such. We saw a lot of issues around food and evictions, organization around neighborhoods, you know, apartment houses. Could you talk about what that tells us about the nature of class struggle in American history?
Well, the first thing to be said is CIO built its power by actually waging class struggle in the more expansive sense, not just in the workplace, right? I mean, it was precisely because they were there to struggle alongside of communities for housing, for rent control, against racism, and so on, that built confidence to build unions in the workplace, right? It was about union power, not just in the workplace, but James Boggs, has this beautiful essay about his experience, about the history of the CIO and his experience in the 1960s. And he says unions wanted to build social power, not just power in the workplace. So the CIO's entire strength and radical development was precisely because of social power. And if we think about that, if you look at the United States right now, I mean, it probably has some of the worst labor laws amongst sort of global North liberal democracies. And if Murphy Oil goes through, it's going to be absolutely appalling. And most places, most union contracts basically have no strike clauses and so on. How do we reverse this situation has been the main strategic concern of all leftists in the U.S., right? But the question is, union density is at its lowest right now. So we are not going to talk about an activation, pressing a button to regenerate or rejuvenate the working class on the basis of economic demands in the workplace alone. But we have to talk about the politicization and the radicalization, the capacity of the working class to wage a political struggle addressing the relations of power in society, not just the question of wage. And I think this cannot be achieved by expanding rank and file organizing in the workplace alone, because that kind of union power does not exist as yet. So where do we see most of the struggle taking place right now is on the streets for, you know, Black Lives Matter, for justice for Palestine. We are witnessing since, early this year, a revival of the feminist movement. These are all instances, I would argue, of class struggle, which what we want to talk about right now and we want to think through is creating sort of large social coalitions acting both inside and outside of workplaces, establishing bonds of solidarity and trust between labor activists, anti-racist activists, feminist activists, and so on, and looking at the question of class struggle in this sort of wider social totality. You know, I want to hence kind of come down to the question of feminism. Like, what would we say today is a feminist issue? And this is something that really troubles me when liberals talk about feminist issues being more women into positions of power within capitalism, right? I mean, that's one track that liberal feminism or lean-in feminism has taken. So the feminist issue then is, how empowered are you to control the levers of the system? So that's a feminist issue. But for me, and for those of us who do social reproduction theory, universal healthcare, universal childcare, these are fundamentally feminist issues. I mean, if you look at the question of reproductive rights, right? So that is understood by all people as a feminist issue. But liberal feminists say that reproductive rights are about the control of our bodies and ovaries, right? And that's absolutely true. That is the absolute first step. Social reproduction feminists would say, well, actually, what is it about the birth of a child that is most important? Yes, the control over our bodies, the right to have a child is also important in this country of, you know, forced sterilization of Black and Puerto Rican women. So the right to have a child and the right not to have a child is absolutely fundamentally the first thing about reproductive rights. But the question, if you do decide to have a child, when to have the child, what are the factors that decide that? Those factors would be what kind of wage you have, what kind of healthcare you have, whether this society has childcare for you after your child is born, whether you or the child's other parent are going to be put in prison for, you know, crossing the street or trying to sell a loose cigarette. Those are fundamental issues that determine a decision about childbirth or not to have a child. So it is not about the question of control over our ovaries. It is the question of who works, for how long, and for whom, that are the fundamental preconditions to that kind of narrow notion of reproductive rights. It is no longer possible in this society, which is headed towards environmental disaster and economic disaster, it is no longer possible to limit a feminist agenda to narrowly what are women's issues. The feminist agenda must be a broad coalition of agenda that is against the system as a whole. So it's not about whether we want to be part of the system as a CEO, but to actually question the existence of CEOs. That should be the agenda of feminism.
Okay, and then with the Me Too business very much in the news, what kind of perspective do you think social reproduction could bring to that?
To go back to our question of what is a feminist issue, it seems that in issues of class struggle, traditional understandings have tried to leave out gender, while in issues of gender struggle, traditional understanding has tried to leave out the workplace. If we look at Me Too as a moment of, you know, sort of gender insurgency against horrible exploitative things that women have faced over the years, it is very clear that this is a wonderful moment. And I absolutely support the toppling of heads of businesses and recording companies and what have you. But the real issue also is what makes the vast majority of women vulnerable in their day-to-day lives. It is the fact that they are low-waged. It is the fact that they have no dignity in their workplace. So the conditions, and this is where, you know, social reproduction says, again, that the processes of life-making and processes of commodity-making are integrated in the sense that the issues of oppression that operate within the domestic sphere absolutely translate into the work sphere and vice versa. So let's think of a general situation where women are paid equal wages as men and not equal wages of low-wage men, that both men and women are paid equal decent wages in the workplace and there is human dignity in the workplace, it would be far more difficult to have this series of unbelievable levels of sexual oppression in the workplace. And if you look at the Me Too campaign, I mean, the most exploited and oppressed of women in the sexual harassment arena are farm workers, are restaurant workers. And while I completely stand with Alyssa Milano and the whole range of Hollywood workers, what are we going to do after, the day after Harvey Weinstein goes away? Because the structures that produce Harvey Weinstein, that allows Harvey Weinstein to operate the way he did, still exist. So what can we do to make sure that no further Harvey Weinsteins are reproduced? And a hashtag and a call out alone is not going to ensure that kind of a movement. For that, we need much wider systemic struggles against capitalist exploitation as a whole and the terrible, undemocratic nature of the workplace.
I'm speaking with Tithi Bhattacharya, a professor of South Asian history at Purdue and the editor of the collection Social Reproduction Theory from Pluto Press.
Another issue, the fight over pensions. We've seen in the United States over the last several decades, you know, the replacement of the defined benefit pension by the defined contribution pension, a lessening of pension coverage in general. Trump has been running around the last few days asking, how's your 401k doing? Because the stock market's at record highs. Most people don't have 401ks, and even those who do have a trivial amount of stock in them. Dozens of countries around the world have privatized their pension system to varying degrees. It looks like the Republicans, having passed this, just about to pass this horrible tax bill, are going to move in on Social Security and Medicare next. How can we think about the pension issue in a social reproduction context?
Well, I think social reproduction is all about the pension issue because, you know, unfortunately for capitalism, a child is merely a future worker, while an old person is an ex-worker or a past worker, right? So capitalism sees all the benefits that are accorded to these two categories of human lives in those terms of their relationship to work. The New York Times just reported that, first of all, the United States has the worst care for people after work. And so the pension system is absolutely devastatingly bad for the vast majority of workers. And so as a result, what ends up happening is people just work longer. And this is not just true for, you know, low-wage jobs. It is more true for low-wage jobs, but it is also true for medium-income jobs, for teachers, for professors, etc. You know, when I first got my job in America, my parents were absolutely shocked to hear that there was no official age of retirement because they both were professors and they retired at age 60, one of them, and the other at 65, and had beautiful pensions provided for by the government for the rest of their lives. And they were shocked that I had no retirement age. And so, but the result of this is that the New York Times reported that the labor force participation rate for those 75 and older are now rising, and it is likely to be over 10% by 2026. I found that whole statistics absolutely horrifying because every day you see, as I told you about my experience with the target worker, every day in our daily lives, we see more and more people who are over 70 who are working longer and longer hours. But if this becomes instituted as policy, which is what it is going to be if they if this tax bill passes, Congress is calling for, what is it, over $1 trillion cuts to Medicaid. Now, Medicaid provides health care coverage to over 33 million women and girls. And so, I mean, what that is going to do for senior citizens in this country is it's absolutely unimaginable. So, you know, I often think of the famous lines, you know, we always think of Marxism as, you know, smashing the system, replacing capitalism, etc. But at this point of my life, I often think of the argument that Walter Benjamin makes, that perhaps our job is right now, or the job of a working class uprising, is to simply put brakes on the system, because the system is spiraling out of control. This is the early part of the beginnings of industrial capitalism. I mean, I think one of the best social reproduction theory books is Capital Volume 1, but it should be paired with The Condition of the Working Class in England by Engels, where there are no brakes on capitalism and the entire working class family is sucked into the maws of these giant factories in Manchester and Lancashire. And the conditions that that kind of policies visits upon ordinary people's lives is horrifying. People just die off because there are no brakes upon the system. And I think we are almost at a tipping point with that, with workers' lives globally, but we are also at a tipping point, a much worse tipping point, I would say, from the early dawn of capitalism, because we are at a tipping point with the environment. So the world is going to burn and our lives along with it, unless some kind of a brake is put on the system. And I guess I can imagine that more than simply smashing the system at this point. I think the brake needs to be put almost immediately.
One of the contributors to your book, Chinzi Oruza, was one of the organizers of the women's strike last March. She was on the show then to talk about it. You were involved in planning that as well. The whole idea of a women's strike was mocked by some of our workerist comrades as irrelevant and silly. But in light of what we've been talking about, what was the thinking behind this women's strike? What were its aims and how was it different from your conventional conception of a strike?
So women's strikes have always been more expansive in their targets and aims than traditional walkouts over wages and working conditions. So 1975, 90% of Iceland's women struck in the not just in the workplace, but refused to perform unpaid domestic work for a day to make visible the work of women. Similarly, fall of 2016, Polish women adopted a similar strategy and went on strike. In other words, not just in the workplace, but as women in society, and organized a massive women's strike to stop a bill in parliament that would have banned abortions. So all of these braided histories of strikes informed our notions of the International Women's Strike of March 8th. And, you know, it was an international call that was internationally coordinated by women in 50 different countries. So Chinzia and I were lucky and fortunate to be part of the organizing strategy in the U.S., but I want to emphasize that it was very, very international in nature and scope. So the idea was that women's work is invisibilized in many ways, both in conception and in policymaking. So first of all, the formal economy is not the only place that women work, although a vast number of women work in the formal economy. Women work in the informal economy, and the vast amount of women in the Global South, for instance, work in the informal economy. So stopping work in the workplace and being registered as having stopped work has different sort of calibrations as well, because the formal economy is calibrated in a certain way and the informal is calibrated in others. But beyond the workplace, there is also women's work. So the idea behind the strike was to visibilize also those invisible, tremendous amount of invisible labor that go into producing the life of society. So if women did not do domestic work, if they did not do care work, then society would stop moving and labor power wouldn't be produced. And certainly labor power would not be generationally reproduced and biologically reproduced as well. And this includes the work of both cis women and trans women, I would like to emphasize. So that was the idea behind the women's strike, that to make clear the work that women perform and to strike against the totality of capitalist society rather than just the workplace. And I want to say why we thought that IWS was, or the International Women's Strike, was the right model for a fight back under neoliberalism. Because, yes, we were not, as organizers and national organizers, we were not all union organizers, and we were not working in workplaces. Although I have to emphasize, several unions participated in the March 8 strike. In fact, the New York March was led by nurses. But what I want to emphasize is, yes, the strike did not begin in the workplace. However, the confidence that women acquired through the process of organizing a national strike, the kind of conversations we began to be having nationally, the several strike committees that were set up in various cities across the United States, actually created the confidence for women to have the same approach in the workplace. So as you probably know very well, it did begin outside of the workplace, but as a result of this kind of activity and conversation and insurgency, three school districts closed down on March 8th of this year. The Alexandria City Public Schools in Virginia, the Prince George's Public School in Maryland, and the Chapel Hill Carborough School District in North Carolina. Both Virginia and North Carolina are right-to-work states. So this sort of clinical and actually unproductive division between workplace struggle and non-workplace struggle was actually proved wrong by the organizing of March 8th.
Well, and also the union, traditional union-based struggles really confront specific capitals or industrial sectors, but not capital as a whole. What you're talking about really is about confronting capital as a whole, the totality of a system, and trying to challenge it.
Right. I mean, I just listened to a really interesting podcast from Britain, and they were talking about organizing delivery workers in their various workplaces. So these are sort of the gig economy or workers, as they as capitalists like to call them. One of the strike organizers was reporting on the fact that the worker was not particularly eager to join the union to begin with, because union power was not something in this particular worker's memory from recent times that actually improved working class life conditions. What ended up happening was these various workers were living in particular housing estate, and the landlords of this housing estate were raising the rent indiscriminately and cutting off heat. And so the union, which is a much newer union, it's not the most traditional union, the union went into the housing estate and said, I don't care if you're in the union or not, we are going to organize a rent strike, and we're going to do some housing justice work here in order to make sure that your heat is not cut off and you're not exploited by your landlord. It is when they started working on the housing struggle that the working class families were far more interested in joining this struggle, because this was about their immediate living conditions. And the particular worker that they interviewed, he said, this was a question of whether my baby has heat at night. Of course I will join this struggle. And so that was an immediate, tangible struggle that the worker felt very comfortable joining. And it is because the union had managed to win trust, had managed to build solidarity in their real life struggles that later on the entire community decided to join the union in their workplace because they realized that these two issues were connected. I have heard Jane McAlevey being interviewed on this particular program, Doug, and I think her approach to that she wants to organize the total worker is a wonderful concept. And, you know, certain radical unions in recent times, like the Chicago Teachers Union, has taken up that approach, a social justice unionism, and I think we need to see more of that.
We've been listening to an interview with Tithi Bhattacharya, editor of Social Reproduction Theory from Pluto Press and a professor of South Asian history at Purdue. About 10 minutes ago, Tithi quoted Walter Benjamin, or Walter Benjamin, for those of you who say Deutschland, as saying that rather than wholesale transformation, our job right now is to put brakes on the system. That feels right, but I was also reminded of Joseph Schumpeter's comment that the mere husbanding of already existing resources, no matter how painstaking, is always characteristic of a declining position. It's hard to put a brake on a mighty and dominant system when you have so little power that it's impossible to imagine a serious change of route. Alas, though, that's where we are. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some of This Funeral Is for the Wrong Corpse by the Mekons. Till next week, one hopes. Bye.
That's some socialism's grave. This funeral's for the wrong cause. This is my testimony, a dinosaur's confession. But how can something really be dead when it hasn't even happened? Democracy is an alibi. The peaceful country is an ordered cemetery. What we call a sane man is now an impotent man.